My name is Joe Barnt, and I'm from New York City. And the title of this presentation or this discussion is There's a Lump of Salt at the End of the Rainbow, or Racism Revisited. The title comes from an experience we had last night, and last night was sort of filled with a lot of symbolism for me. And the first one, I don't know how many of you saw the rainbow last night. Actually, what we saw from the porch of Chalet 1 was a double rainbow down across the valley, which was just absolutely gorgeous. And of course, we decided that it was a very significant symbol for our Rainbow Week here in the mountain, as I'm sure you did too. But then we made a discovery, and that was that the end of one of the rainbows was right behind Chalet 1. And so we went to looking at the end of the rainbow to find the pot of gold, and found that the rainbow ended. Do you know where the deer come? And ended right on top of the salt lake. And decided that there was a symbol there too, because we were in the process of discussing the fact that we were going to do a session on racism tonight, and that there's a lump of salt at the end of the rainbow. May have something to do with the fact that that the rainbow points us in other directions than the promised wealth and lazy relaxation of accomplishment. And I want to come to that in a few moments. I guess there's another symbol, though, that I'd like to, whether or not I come back to it or not, is that the salt at the end of the rainbow may refer also something to the salt of the earth and to a people who are called to a task by a rainbow, too. And so you can drive a symbol to death. I'll stop right there. If we decide to come back to that, that's fine. However, we began to discuss a little bit in the forum the other night, in the Rainbow Forum the other night, and just at the tail end, we then got a few comments. Jody, amongst a couple of others, I think, began to talk a little bit about the fact that there's a double-pronged theme in talking on Rainbow on the Mountain, and the one half of it, the one prong of that theme we've been experiencing and have been experiencing and expect to continue to experience in the next week as the rainbow experience continues, and that is the sense of joy that comes from the multicultural sharing and learning from each other and that we've experienced. I guess it can't be called anything less than a taste of heaven, a foretaste of the things to come. To have the ability of us to break across barriers and to be able to be not only just hearing Marilyn sing and share the gospel from her cultural background, but to have Tress leading us in a rainbow choir, and to have the cultural symbols mix and to hear each other in a new way and to have a vision in a new way across each other's barriers, and to be having a little taste at least of the promise that is ours each time we take that bread and wine and say that that our identity in Christ makes all of us red, brown, yellow, black, and white, the promise that the kingdom coming and a taste already of it here on earth will be one of a full sharing and love across those boundaries and making it truly a rainbow. All of that is the experience that all of us have been having a little taste of here, right? And the joy that it has and the good feeling that it has that comes from that. From the perspective of the valley, of the mountain, however, looking in two directions towards the feast that is to come, Pete Perro has already spoken to us clearly that there's a valley to be gone back to. And the reality that's in that valley does not, for you and for me or for almost anybody, fulfill that vision or even give very often much of the taste of that which we've been having up here. And the question that we need to be asking is why? Why is this such an exceptional experience? Why is it that the reality is not the joy that we've been feeling up here, but the walls that continue to separate us? Why is there a lump of salt at the end of the rainbow? And why is there the reality that we go back to? And what do we do with it? How do we identify it? What's it all about? What do we do with it? Can we, while we're celebrating the vision that God gives to us of not only the way it ought to be, but the way God promises it is, in a real kind of a vision that we can experience at least once in a while, how do we handle and how do we deal with, on the other hand, and what do we do with the hard reality that there's something else out there that we have to live with and are given something to do with as the people of God? I'm not going to spend a lot of time this evening providing the evidence or the data for that. My feeling is that any person here, given the opportunity to talk about his or her own experience, could begin to provide the personal data that makes us all realize that there's some real truth to the hard reality of the walls. I'd be glad to share with here tonight and at any time during the coming week anybody who wants to, and maybe we'll even have some sessions dealing with it more too. Some of the data that's presented to us and that we need to be discussing, and some other kind of things. Urban League puts out every year the State of Black America, and one could also put out comparable books called The State of Hispanic America, The State of Asian America, and The State of Native America, which this is The State of Black America 1987, which goes down all of the measurable categories of progress, the measurable data about how a person or a people's life is going, whether it be housing or salaries or health, or all the measurable ways in which we talk about whether life is going well or not for us, and puts it in the perspective of progress or not, puts it in the perspective of the comparative data between the white community and the black community. And in almost every measurable category, this is a little hard for me, and I suppose for you also to take, because some of us have been working for a long time. And some of us have also been listening to some of the BS that comes out of the White House, who says, where you hear that racial problems have all been solved. In every, almost every measurable category, the actual data of where black people are at, or the relative data in relationship to white population, is the same or more often worse than it was 10 years ago, and especially worse than it was before the Reagan years began. In almost every measurable category. Anybody wants to take a look at that later, you're welcome to. This one's a little bit that I have here. This one just hot off the press, 1987, all the data from 1986. This is the fact sheet on institutional racism from the, it's actually titled the Racial Justice Working Group of the Division of Church and Society, National Council of Churches. And it's put out by a group in New York City called the, Jody, I always forget how to say that. Council on Interracial Books for Children, who deal primarily with children's education and the problems of sexism and racism, but who also do a lot of educational work for adults. And then you may have your own data sources. Simply to say that whether we're listening to the people who are doing the hard data, or just reading the newspapers and hearing the news from Howard Beach, or from the New York City subway system, or whether listening to Bishop Will Hertzfeld talking about the progress in the multicultural efforts in the New Lutheran Church, or listening in the weeks to come with the cameraman in the back of the room, Dr. Perro. There's a lot of hard reality that comes on the other side, the other prong of the fork that we're dealing with up here in the mountain and rainbow. And I want to say a little later, at the end of this session, about how the two, a little bit more about how the two go together, about how celebrating the vision fits with the struggling with the reality and you can't have one without the other. I want to say that again in a couple of more sentences than that at the end of our session. But what I'd like us to do tonight, and you notice now I'm skipping the prong of our celebration. We've already been doing that, and we'll keep doing that. I'm skipping the data on the reality of what's happening as a result of racism. And tonight I'd like us just to focus on the question of what does racism look like in your world and my world in 1987? Not or what is, here's its results. Here's the product, the data of what happens to people of color in our country. But to ask more the question, what does racism look like and how is it functioning in 1987? Now, some of you may be in the more the condition I am, I can talk a lot about how racism functioned way back in history, from the history books in the slavery days and Reconstruction days. I can talk a lot from my personal experience about how racism functioned and worked in the main years that I was working in the civil rights movement in the 60s and the 70s and in the post-civil rights movement in the latter part of the 70s and early 80s. But I don't know if you're surprised or not that it's 1987 and heading for the 1990s. And the data is in the Reagan years, and we're heading for, God help us please, the post-Reagan years. And to ask the question, how does racism function in our day, in this moment, in these years? What does it look like, and how does it work today? And how is that different than it did 10 years ago? How is it different than it did 20 years ago? And I'm not going to make a speech about that, because I'm not as good at that as I'd like to be either. I could do it much better about the 60s and 70s and early 80s. And I'd like us to struggle a bit together about that for a while in small groups, to collect some of the data that's here in this room about how you and I see racism working in our lives today. What I'm going to do is have us break up into groups like about five and take 15 minutes to make some lists together. First of all, I have the five kind of classic categories of racism, although you can break them down in a lot of different ways, in which to give us some categories to start with. There are five kind of areas we might begin to look at to break it down and say, and ask the question, how is racism functioning? Personal, institutional, cultural, church, and global. Now, they overlap. Obviously, church is part of it, is an institution, and cultural is part of it. But let me just give a couple of examples, and you might want to help me out quickly just to think about this. When one thinks of personal racism, we're obviously talking about how you and I might act it out on our own. However, I'm not just talking about how you and I might sort of Ku Klux Klan style go around calling people niggers. I'm talking also about how a person might say, what do you mean there's a problem? What do you mean there's a problem? Now, that doesn't mean their person is consciously saying niggers. Might literally be able to say in the old liberal sense, some of my best friends are. But what do you mean there's a problem means being out of the touch with the reality that people of color are suffering in our country more today than ever in all the measurable data. And so just living in a protected world of not knowing how things are functioning and how things are going is being imprisoned somehow in a world of ignorance that helps to produce on a personal level the racism that just keeps on going. Okay, so see what I mean about a little bit about personal racism? I'm sure nobody in this room would be here if we disliked or hated or did not want to have good relationships with people of color. So what I'm talking about is how you and I get trapped on a personal level into misunderstandings an uncomfortableness, an inability to relate, even though we really want to. So the question for us is, how would you put in a list of things the way personal racism is caused and operates today? How do people still get turned into personal racists, even though we don't want them to? It's true that racists are made and not born. You know, prejudiced people are born. We're all born with natural abilities towards prejudice, but we get trained in the ability or the prison and trapped into the prison in a personal racism. Institutional racism is maybe a little bit more easy to understand, but since the civil rights laws have been passed in the 60s and enforced in the 70s, a lot of institutional racism is getting more tougher to see. For example, a real estate agent, it's against the law for a real estate agent to not show housing to black people and white people alike. So real estate agencies have developed the skill of, I just used the word tracking, what's the word I'm thinking of?
Steering.
And the banks of redlining and so forth, of making housing, racism in housing, take place without anybody actually doing anything. Dick Gregory used to say when he talked about institutional racism, is you take an institution that has all of its policies operating in racist ways, you can replace all the people that work in them, all the white people, with black people. And if it still functions, if all of the policies and practices are carried out, it'll still be doing white racism. You know, even if all the staff are people of color. So institutional racism is getting a little bit harder to look at and to see. But yet, if this data is right, the result of all the institutions is that the data would show that the conditions for people of color and all the measurable results of the work of institutions in our country still is producing terrifying racism in our country. And think that you and I like it. Assume that they're doing it for you and me. Whether it's the police or the schools or the real estate agents or the banks or whatever, that the benefits of that are assumed to be the white population of our country. And if you don't like it, as I'm sure you don't, and I don't like it, as I'm sure I don't, it means that we have our own institutions to protest against, to understand, and to protest against, and to try and change.
Joe, can I add something to that?
Sure.
It seems to me that the institutional racism becomes the hardest to understand for me, and I think in other places that I've seen, because very often it's not even conscious.
That's right.
The examples you were given probably are in some ways conscious, but a lot of times institutional racism is racism that no one will take any responsibility for. And yet
That's right.
it's still racist in terms of the effects of what the policies are, even though those policies weren't made consciously to be exclusive.
That's right. That's right. I'm glad you said that. And maybe when we come back with some illustrations, we can even deal with that some more. One of the important rules of an understanding in racism for me is that you measure it by its results, not by its intent. That none of us would intend to be, and most institutions don't, in their conscious, out-front practices, intend to be racism. But if the result is that, then somewhere in there you're going to find racism. And it's our job to sort of be the Sergeant Fridays who ask the questions. Where is it? How is it? Why is it? Cultural racism is something we're getting more and more in touch with these days than ever. It's because we're getting more and more in touch with the need for to stop our assumption that just letting people of color into our culture is all that's needed. Because making people of color into people who practice the white culture well is this destruction of their culture. And just one quick illustration, to say they got to learn English if they're going to be American is cultural racism. Even if it makes problems for us, that we have to build a multilingual life in certain areas of our life. Church, I don't have to give many illustrations of that because how many of you heard Bishop Hertzfeld? Maybe, I'm not sure if there's so much turnover here. Not many. So then it's not true that just one illustration in the new Evangelical Lutheran Church in America, which has, we can thankfully say, some very strong rules about representation for women and lay people and people of color on all the boards and all the staffs of the national and synodical and regional levels of the church. And all of that is good, but there are some levels where that does not control and immediately comes out the wrong way. All of our elections for bishop are just about over. There's three more, one of them today. But so far, within the continental United States, all white male bishops. They've appointed all of the executives of the major divisions and offices and assistants to the presiding bishop. And so far, one person of color, and that's for the division that requires a person of color, and two women, of the four women, two of them in the divisions which require women to be, so that as soon as the quota requirements go away, we're trapped into an institutional racism that we don't know how to do what we really want to do. And then global, that's not a chance to get the question off our back and say they're doing it in South Africa and we're okay. But the question is, how does the United States participate? How does the United States participate in a kind of racism that affects the rest of the globe? That's easy to answer historically. Martin Luther King, the year before he died, the year before he was killed, came to the realization of the interrelationship between what he called the racist war in Vietnam and racism in the United States, and saw the global and national intertwining. But that's in the 1960s. How in 1987 is our global influences the maintaining of racism on a global level? Okay, what I'm going to ask you to do in breaking up into small groups is not do all of these, because we only have 15 minutes. But take the first 30 seconds and choose for yourself which two you'd like to work on first. And when you finish those two, if you want to go on, but to make as, and you don't have to go into deep analysis, come out with lists. Where do you see and how do you see racism in our society in 1987 functioning in such a way that it produces the results that nobody wants and that keeps us from being able to celebrate the same thing down in the valley that we've been celebrating up here in the mountain? Let's see what kind of results we get when we just collect some lists of these and see what kind of picture comes out at the end. It'll be very interesting and learning experience for us. You first?
Okay.
All right. Tell me what categories you chose first.
We chose personal and institutional.
Okay.
Under personal, one of them was a black boyfriend was brought to a class reunion and nobody acknowledged the fact that they were together. Another one was being from a certain part of the country, assumptions were made that this person was racist.
I'm sorry, say that again.
Just being from a certain part of the country, people assumed that this person was racist.
Mm-hmm.
Person with a...
Is that part of the country, the South?
Texas.
Yeah.
As opposed to South.
Another one, a person with a biracial son comments on how well coordinated he is and they expect him to be a good athlete or maybe a dancer. These are other family members. And when he acts out, that's also expected because he's black. And another one was person dating a black said that the parents said it was okay, but not to get serious. And what about the children? Okay. And then under,
that's one of the oldest ones. One with the children married one, right?
And then under institutional, universities when they house their the people they met, their roommates are done by race. And also at the universities, when the fraternities have their rush invitations, they skip the blacks.
That's that. Did you switch to
institutional?
Institutional?
Yeah.
Okay.
Sorry. Also, somebody was saying that in Texas, the death penalty is more likely to be given to somebody if it's a black killing a white.
Actually, that's across the country.
Also, very recent, by the way, in terms about the way things are expressed in 87, one of the most recent rulings of the Supreme Court said that's okay. That the discrimination by race is an irrelevant factor. That I'm slightly simplifying the ruling, but the result was saying that the discrimination of the electorate chair by race is an irrelevant factor to the sentencing and carrying it out.
There's a Baptist student union, and they have a black group and a white group. And talking about recruiting, the small liberal arts schools do not recruit in the black high schools. Mm-hmm. And even though they have financial aid, it would not allow for the people to go to those schools. And then about hospitals, they say that hospitals are recruiting people, advertising people to come because they want paying patients, and they are recruiting whites to come. This is true in the regular hospitals, also said in psychiatric hospitals. And another example was that one of the big hospitals in the black area has a huge mural at the beginning of their maternity ward of a blonde, blue-eyed family.
Something Cheryl Stewart was talking about a lot in imaging is applied to that, both TV or artwork, whatever it is, absolutely. All the messages that can be brought through. The institution doesn't have to say a word. Okay, who's reporting over in that area over there?
On the personal avoidance of seeking contact with peoples of other races. Okay. If self-employed, avoidance of seeking business, and which makes it on a personal level because it's a personal choice to minority-owned businesses. Form tight circles, though informal, that exclude social. Also economic circles. For instance, if you're in an investment club or... this was brought up in a different context, and I'm kind of interpolating here.
To a personal institution.
Yeah, avoidance of seeking minority businesses or professional services on a personal level.
Mm-hmm. A black architect.
A black doctor or a black lawyer, or you know, that if I were white, I probably wouldn't make that effort. On the institutional, only handing out token work or jobs to minority-owned businesses or professionals. In other words, adhering to the law, but not going along with the spirit, and intentionally making it minor, small jobs, not the plush where you make some profit.
Mm-hmm.
The cream. Yeah, I think that's better.
What's that?
There was one that I'd like to struggle with explaining on the personal level too, was a new level of comfortability with racism that may be a flip-flop reversal that was expressed in our group, and therefore, and the way it was explained is that if there's a problem on the job, that immediately the minority people in the situation are are sought out. Is this a racial thing? Real, that level of comfortability that, that tends to sidetrack from dealing with the real issues and the real problems or the facts and getting on with business.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
That's a little expression of the kind of token or least common denominator level doing what's absolutely necessary.
Well, no, it, the way I heard it, it was the way I understood it, and it, it's the, it's a reversal. It's a comfortability with racism and willing to kind of indulge racism rather than
rather than putting it away and saying, now it's time to get the job done together.
Mm-hmm.
We don't have to go on and on about
your
color.
You're not allowed to do your job.
Mm-hmm.
You were hired to do a job. Now you're not allowed to do it, because anytime something comes up that relates directly to the job itself, then if there's a problem, well, they want to deal with it from a racial standpoint, and there's that comfortability.
Mm-hmm.
Well, let's talk about it from that standpoint, not dealing with facts.
Okay.
Now that I think about it, I'd like to add the personal, the avoidance of sessions like this.
Oh, yeah.
Which is, I hope, not a self-righteous statement.
Okay. We're all here, so we...
Not for me.
Sure, anybody but us, right? Okay, session group over here. Who's
who was it?
Who's recording?
I don't know what we wrote. I think we generally sort of talk about institutional and cultural more than anything. Yeah.
Yeah, we decided it was important to talk and amongst ourselves and perhaps start...
Somebody was recording in your group, weren't they?
Yes.
Oh. Do you have something to report? Oh, no.
All right, well,
okay,
I was saying that one, racism tends to, it nowadays is shown in the younger population. And at least that's been sort of the experience of me, and no one jumped on me in disagreement. Especially among teens and college people, students now, even more so than before. There was a general assumption at one time that because one was younger, or one of the children of the Aquarius age, that they didn't have those attitudes. That's proven itself to be not only false, but an absolute untruth, a lie.
Okay.
So that is changing. Also, we talked about the avoidance, at least the problem of institutional racism when it comes to, what was it, loans,
gentrification,
regentrification, the abuse of people within that, regentrification in the urban areas where the younger professional, or where people are moving into old industrial areas, or communities which have been somewhat run down, and they displace the current population, which generally tends to be poorer. And so in that case, it's not just racism, but also classism.
Okay.
And so we see that there's an expectation institutionally that even though a person may be a brilliant student in high school, being a person of color, once they get to an institution of higher learning, they're expected to not perform as well, or they're expected to fail. Therefore, they do.
Okay.
Also, just the priority of resources in urban school systems as opposed to non-urban school systems.
Yuppies are bailing out.
There's a major expose in New York City about how that even worked out the other day of the north part of the Bronx compared to the south part of the Bronx, where I lived. The priority of resources. Oh, very important.
And I made one remark that as a black pastor within our Lutheran denomination, I'm ordained to be a servant of the church. I'm ordained to serve the whole church. But there's a very minute fraction of that church which I'm actually allowed not only to serve, but even to become acquainted with.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
access for black bastards.
Mine is even more my universe.
Heard that. Okay. We can't be late for Vespers, so we're going to go on. Okay. We want to at least get the list out so we can find out what people are thinking.
We focused on cultural and church.
Uh-huh.
And for church, an example of that was a church convention which attempted to bypass the inclusive rules in committees by saying if subcommittees were formed from the committees, they would not have to be inclusive. And there was a concerted effort on behalf of pastors of color and friends to forestall that happening, and it was not passed.
Okay.
But there was an attempt to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Then in terms of cultural, we're talking about graduations, and in white schools, eighth grade graduation is really sort of no big deal. I mean, it's just a ceremony that you go through because the kids have graduated. And yet, in schools where there is a very high or all black enrollment, it will be quite a big production because the expectation is that these children will probably not go on to graduate from high school, which unfortunately many times is true. And then the other thing is the beginning birth control clinics in schools. It's not seen that there are very many of these, if any, that are being started in all-white schools, and if there's a lot of them across the country that are being started in schools where there are many students of color. Another, especially in the New York area, there seems to be a great increase in the number of enrollments in private schools to avoid being in the public school system. Then in the Native American communities in southwestern Minnesota, there's an attitude on behalf of the white people who live adjacent to the reservations that these people don't exist. As long as they don't create problems, and as long as they sort of mind their own business, then they're just really ignored.
Okay. Quickly. Is another one over in here?
Oh, yeah, but go ahead.
Pardon?
You can put real fast.
We focused on the personal and the church. And some of the examples were, basically the relationships that occur are primarily with Indians. People will say they get along with them, but they don't know any. Then in another area, there's a big deal about fishing rights, as how come they don't get treated the same way white folks get treated? Why shouldn't everybody be the same? Who does own the fish and the deer? And then the bumper sticker that was brought out, what was it, Spirit Indian, say Walla? Spear fishing rights. And an attitude among small business people that when there's a screw up, it's one of them that screws up. I'd like to.
Pardon?
Yeah, can we continue this later?
Well,
it's too valuable, I think, to forego.
Well, probably not, but it's a taste, you know. Let it be a taste. Let me just, if you'll let me, please, I'd just like to just say one thing in closing, because it's another ring. Never mind, I won't. Let me just simply say that this is a taste. Just as all of this good other prong is a taste of the vision, then let's make this session and some of the other sessions that we can still do while some of you are still here, I hope, another taste of the task we've got to do in the valley. And you can't have either one of those prongs without the other. And I'd like to say more about that in another session.